My guest at this time is Michael Cutler. He served for 30 years for the Immigration and Naturalization Service, which, of course, was the forerunner to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, today known as ICE. We want to get his insights on what he believes U.S. immigration policy ought to be, as much of the Western Hemisphere deals with the outbreak of the Zika virus. Right now, it's afflicting Brazil especially, but other nations in South and Latin America. And we want to know what he believes ought to be the right U.S. policy as we try to prevent it from coming north of the Rio Grande. And Mike, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Greg. I'll just put a couple of quick shameless plugs out there because I'd love your audience to check out some of the stuff I've been writing about. My own personal website is michaelcutler.net. I write for capsweb.org, Californians for Population Stabilization. And, in fact, today, Front Page Magazine, The Social Contract, actually, Front Page I write for also, but The Social Contract has published my article on the threat posed by sanctuary cities, and, of course, the administration is doing nothing about it. In fact, they're doing nothing about immigration at all except to make things worse, notwithstanding the threat of the Zika virus. Notwithstanding the fact that the 9/11 Commission, to which I provided testimony, made it clear that it was failures of the immigration system that have enabled terrorists to not only enter our country but hide in plain sight as they went about their deadly preparations, and we've seen that continuing. As for the Zika virus, Ellis Island, which we hear so much about from the open borders anarchists, as I've come to call them, was a quarantine station run by public health in conjunction with immigration. And when you look at the categories for excluding aliens, item one on that list, and by the way, it does not have anything to do with race, religion, ethnicity. That's, again, one of those ridiculous arguments we keep hearing about. But it starts out with aliens with dangerous communicable diseases. Now, everything that I've been reading thus far, Greg, indicates that the virus is generally spread by mosquitoes.
Right.
But I don't know that that's accurate. And I don't think that the scientific community knows that that's the sole way for the transmission of this disease. So I think the first thing that we need to do, and the world has declared this a global emergency, by the way, so obviously we need to know how it's transmitted. If it doesn't ever get transmitted person to person, that's one thing. But if there's a potential that humans can pass the virus, whether it's through intimate contact, not-so-intimate contact, whatever the problem is, then we need to understand that we have got to be careful as to who we let into the United States, that it's not only the Zika virus. It was astonishing to me that the AIDS virus no longer precludes a foreign national from visiting the United States. We're doing so much in the name of tourism to placate the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and others who are making a huge profit by the movement of people across international borders, whether they're students, tourists, or cheap labor, that we've lost our way. We've lost the understanding that a country's security, first and foremost, begins at its borders, and its borders exist any place where there's an international airport or a seaport or a land border crossing.
Well, Mike, what is the general policy for immigration officials when something like this happened? It happens from time to time with various different viruses. Generally, will they wait and see until people better understand this in the scientific community before making policy? Or will there be steps taken proactively to limit the likelihood of Zika coming into the country while those scientists try to figure everything out?
Well, the only way to know if a person is infected with certainty would obviously be to do a blood test. But I can tell you that I began my 30-year career with the old INS as an immigration inspector assigned to Kennedy International Airport. We work closely with public health. So if we saw somebody obviously showing signs of illness, they were immediately referred to public health, and they would then make the call as to whether or not the person should be put into quarantine, taken to a hospital. I remember one young boy came in from Jamaica, and his eyes were encrusted. When I touched his forehead, I felt as though I could fry an egg on his head. I immediately got my bosses. The kid was taken to a hospital. He was running, I think, 105 or 105 and a half fever. I mean, it was a life-threatening situation. And he was quarantined. I would hope that our officials move swiftly to determine just how easily the Zika virus can be transmitted, and if, in fact, it can be transmitted to person to person. But between now and that determination, It's up to the administration. It's up to the president to establish the policies. And I got to be honest with you. I have zero confidence in this president, this administration, to do anything that might impede the flow of foreign nationals into the United States. You know, everything that this administration has done has been to basically dismantle our immigration system, our laws, our borders. And this isn't the first administration to do it. I wasn't happy with the Bush administration either. But this administration has absolutely taken the door off the hinges.
Talk about, in addition to the individual examples you mentioned while you were working in your early days at Immigration and Naturalization, what generally has been the immigration policy towards outbreaks? Whether it's a previous administration, whether it's a generation or more ago, what would be the precedent for this?
Well, we've always had the precedent of saying that if you have a dangerous disease, you're not coming in. But unfortunately, again, this push for globalism, basically that's been stampeded through the system by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which, by the way, is the force behind the expansion of the visa waiver program, to show you how hell-bent we've become. The 9/11 Commission said that the process by which visas were issued was flawed, fatally flawed, and that we needed to tighten up the process. On 9/11, we had 26 visa waiver countries. You would have thought we would have ended the visa waiver program. Today, because of the Chamber of Commerce in large measure, we now have 38 such countries whose citizens don't need visas to enter the United States. And Congress, this pusillanimous body of spineless, gutless individuals, has said, well, you know, anybody who should be able to enter under the visa waiver program, if they've been to Syria or some other such country in the last 5 years, then they'll need a visa. Do they really think a terrorist is going to walk in to the State Department at an embassy or consulate overseas or a port of entry in the United States and say, oh, and by the way, I just spent the last 8 months in Syria learning how to make improvised explosive devices so that I can blow up cars? No, what we're doing is failing as a nation to protect our own citizens. What should be done, what has been done, they would say, if you're coming from that country, we're going to take a blood test. We're going to put you in quarantine. Don't hold your breath expecting that to happen today.
Mike, one of the things we know, of course, is that it can be transmitted from mother to unborn child, and that is perhaps where some of the worst effects of that are seen, with the smaller heads and other medical problems that the kids are dealing with.
Microcephaly, yes.
Yes, exactly. So some of this may not be manifest for months or even years.
No, that's right. But of course, forgive me, there's nothing humorous about it, but if you want to look for small heads, look among our politicians, apparently. I just don't understand how a politician can take an oath of office and promise to the people in their communities that when they get elected to Congress, they will look out for those people's best interests. And they get to Congress, and they take political campaign contributions that, in my world, are nothing short of legalized bribes. And you listen to Hillary Clinton, and I want you to know, I'm registered as a Democrat. I've always voted as an independent. I hate both parties. I compare them to the drug cartels of Latin America, you know, the Medellin versus the Cali cartel that would stop at nothing to control turf. But, you know, this isn't about being partisan. You look at Hillary Clinton, who can turn around and say, what difference does it make when four people, including an ambassador, die on her watch, who's furious that she's being made accountable for the way that she handled highly classified national security-related material. You know, my clearance was top secret, nowhere near what her clearance was. I had a safe in my office. I spent half my career with the Drug Task Force. I've arrested terrorists. If I left that safe in my own secured office unlocked, I was looking at a severe disciplinary situation. Could you imagine if I had taken materials from my safe home with me? You wouldn't be able to interview me now because I'd be in Leavenworth or some other correctional facility. So understand that when we look at where our politicians are today, I have to be honest with you, Greg, it leaves me in a state of fury. This is not representing the American people. This is not abiding by oaths of office or the Constitution. Both parties bear responsibility. It was the Republican-controlled Congress, both the House and Senate, that passed the omnibus spending bill. I call it the ominous spending bill, bankrolling every single thing down the line that this administration wants to implement. For all of their ranting and raving and screaming and posturing before the cameras, you know, when Obama took out that magic pen and his magic phone and started issuing executive orders, the first thing that the Republicans said was, oh, he's violating the rule of law and the Constitution. So let's back up and think about something. Most people are not really understanding just how significant the Constitution is. Number two, many people drive their cars with radar detectors attached to the dashboard. I don't think they much care about rule of law as long as it doesn't affect them. The most important argument, the most urgent and demanding argument that could have been made is that he's undermining national security. And that would have brought everybody out screaming and ranting and raving, what are you doing? I believe the Republicans didn't use that nuclear but reasonable and fact-based argument because they're happy with what he's doing. Both sides of the aisle want this massive influx of foreign workers, foreign students, foreign tourists, because all they could see is money. And they're forgetting that they're destroying the middle class. And I know we're going afield, but I have to make the point for you and your audience because this has been driving me crazy, so I may as well vent it on your program. You know, when oil prices went through the roof, the economy got hammered, and everybody said, you know, petroleum is such a big part of what costs our economy its vibrancy. Well, now that petroleum has fallen through the floorboards, the price of petroleum, we're being told that it's the cost of petroleum being so low that's hurting the economy. None of the above is true, and I'm not an economist, but I really believe that what's killing our economy is what's killing our middle class. Unfair competition by foreign workers. We now are bringing in more authorized foreign workers, authorized, allowed to work in the United States, than the number of new jobs that we are creating. And they are sending more than $200 billion a year in remittances out of our economy. That alone more than accounts for the annual growth of the U.S. national debt. So when you look at immigration, and I look at it, you look at it, I will guarantee you that the politicians don't see the same thing. They see a cash cow. They see the way to get people to contribute to their campaigns because it runs contrary to what's in the best interest of America and Americans. You know, when people give you that campaign contribution, if it's $100, there's no expectation you're going to get anything for it. But when this checkbook comes out and they're writing checks, the contributors, for thousands and thousands of dollars and God knows what else, I guarantee you there's an expectation that is being met that those contributions will buy them whatever it is they're looking for.
Mike, last question. You mentioned the blood test that could be used to determine whether folks coming in are afflicted with the Zika virus. How simple or how difficult is that logistically to set up at all the ports of entry?
Very difficult. And then you've got the additional problem about the illegal aliens who run the border. For all the talk that we've heard about how we're not vetting the Syrian refugees, let's remember that aliens who evade the inspections process, in essence, trespass on America, are not being vetted at all. So, you know, again, we need to understand that immigration isn't just about supposedly securing the Mexican border. We're a country of 50 border states. The entire immigration system lacks integrity, and that lack of integrity is a reflection of the lack of integrity of our politicians.
Mike, we'll leave it there. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. And by the way, folks, if this gets your motor running, please get involved. I always like to remind people that democracy is not a spectator sport.
Mike Cutler served 30 years with the Immigration and Naturalization Service, which in more recent years has become known as Immigrations and Customs Enforcement. I'm Greg Corumbus reporting for Radio America.